Hello, you're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts while applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today, we have Karen Frost, Caitlin Hopkins, and Laura Luthi, and I'm your host, Bobby Jane Apostolos. Details on our backgrounds can be found in the podcast bio. Although all four of our participants today do work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. Welcome to our creative and imaginative world of Gossip Int. All right, so last week we talked about serial killers. Did you guys see the cops in Stockton? They actually caught that guy and he's been charged. It sounds like there was an escalation activity over an extended period of time, ambushing his victims in the streets at night. Did you guys hear about that one?
Yeah, talk about a timely news story. And just as we discussed, it wasn't a young white guy who abducted women and killed them with a knife or by strangulation. That pattern we classically think of for serial killers. This time, the suspect, a black man in his 40s, shot his male victims with a gun. I love statistics in general because of the stories they tell. And few things are more interesting than crime statistics, which give us insight into what crimes are committed by whom and against whom.
Well, dang, I guess there has been a lot of timely news about serial killers. Did either of you hear about the woman in Iowa who came forward saying that her now deceased father, Daniel Studi, was a serial killer who hid bodies in a well? She went to the police saying he was responsible for somewhere between 50 and 70 deaths. And according to local news, police are actively investigating. And while nothing has really been substantiated yet, cadaver dogs did indicate in the area. So if all this is true, Daniel Studi would be one of, if not the serial killer in the United States with the most victims.
For the record, Samuel Little confessed to murdering 93 women. But both men, at least allegedly, killed primarily prostitutes, which is also true of other killers like the Green River Killer. Honestly, this suggests that if the U.S. legalized and registered sex workers as the Netherlands do, we would catch killers like them much faster, because we would quickly see when sex workers in a particular area went missing. A few might be a coincidence, but 10, 50, 70, you know you've got a predator in the area.
Yeah, that was hard not to interrupt you guys with how crazy that is. So I'll definitely be following that stuff. And if it's true, it's only a matter of time until there's a true crime podcast released about it. And I know I'm seriously addicted. I wanted to mention this to you guys last week. A little bit of confession. I am plowing through podcasts like so fast. I actually have increased the speed. My partner is like, okay, that's a little crazy. I'm like, no, I get to hear more. I just get through faster. I get to hear more podcasts in a day because we only have so much time. One that I love a lot is Vanished. I don't know if you guys have heard of that.
Nope, I haven't.
Not me either.
Okay, so it's really good. And I do have some tidbits of advice. One, don't ever go missing. Just don't do it. But if you do, make sure they find your body. It is wild. So if you go missing, even under mysterious circumstances and the evidence of guilt of who done it, who was involved, if they don't have a body, it is so difficult to bring anyone to justice.
There are so many true crime podcasts, and they all sound interesting. If only I had more time. Oh well, maybe when I'm retired. That reminds me. I mentioned in the last episode the name Guy Deray. Guy Deray is an example of the intersection of two historical points. Nowadays, Guy Deray is known as the world's first identified serial killer, a mass murderer of children who allegedly killed somewhere between 100 to 200 of them before he was executed for his crimes. But Guy Deray had another role in history. He was assigned by the Dauphin of France to be Joan of Arc's protector and fought beside her in multiple battles. At the young age of 25, he was even named a Marshal of France, the highest military honor one could achieve. This presents an interesting situation. Did Joan, who claimed to receive visions from God, fail to be notified that the man beside her was a psychopathic murderer? Or was he framed just like Joan was? His titles and wealth, well, what remained of it at any rate, since he was a massive spendthrift who was hurtling towards even bigger bankruptcy, taken by scheming rivals? It's awfully coincidental that he was accused of trying to summon devils, because back in the day, that was almost worse than murdering literally dozens and possibly hundreds of peasant children.
Yeah, that is a little backwards. And I know we can continue talking about crime and true crime and serial killers forever. But now, alongside true crime, there is a little podcast about structured analytic techniques and cognitive bias. So today, we are still sticking to cognitive biases. So Karen, start us off on what today's bias is.
Today's bias is called the Dunning-Kruger effect. This is a cognitive bias in which people with low ability, expertise, or experience overestimate their ability or knowledge. I want to emphasize right here from the outset that this has nothing to do with intelligence. It only has to do with ability. That means that the smartest person in the world can easily fall into this bias. At one time or another, we all will.
Okay, so that sounds a little loaded for a start. Can you elaborate a little bit for us, Karen?
Imagine you're in a classroom of people and you're all given a test. You're then asked to rate how well you think you did on the test and how well you think you did relative to the other people in the room. The lowest performers are likely to both overestimate how well they did overall and how well they did compared to their peers. Studies have shown this effect exists across all subjects. Business, driving, medicine, politics, you name it. If we put it in plain language, we might say the worse someone is at something, the better they think they are at it. Or to use the title of Dunning and Kruger's 1999 study that identified what's now called the Dunning-Kruger effect, unskilled and unaware of it, how difficulties in recognizing one's own incompetence lead to inflated self-assessments. Ouch! Dunning doesn't mince words when he describes the effects of his own research.
Okay, so a couple questions here. One, we all fall into this bias, all of us. And two, how can people really be unaware of how good they are in relative to other people? Clearly, people should notice if they're not hitting hole-in-ones on the golf course or sinking free throws or whatever, right?
That last one is a good question, but we're not necessarily talking about just one person throwing or hitting a ball. Dunning hypothesizes that the source of the Dunning-Kruger effect may be a problem of metacognition. Poor performers don't have the ability to distinguish between good and bad performances. It's like if I tried to paint an abstract painting like Jackson Pollock. I could sling paint on a canvas and say my art looks like his, but I would be wrong. I'm not trained in art criticism. To me, they really would look the same. I genuinely would believe they had the same value. But to someone who actually understands art, they would look worlds apart. This is called the dual burden account. The Dunning-Kruger effect entails both a lack of skill and a lack of awareness that the skill is lacking.
Okay, so is this like, you don't know what you don't know?
Right. Think of metacognition as being like self-introspection. If you don't use it or have it, you'll struggle to understand how you fit into the world around you. So to go back to my example of students in a classroom, those with good metacognition probably have a good understanding of the bell curve of performance and how they fit on it, while students with bad metacognition don't.
Without trying to be inflammatory, is it safe to say that the majority of our listeners believe they have good metacognition?
Well, most of our listeners have probably never heard the word metacognition. I know I hadn't before this podcast. Fun fact, papers exploring the Dunning-Kruger effect have absolutely brutal titles. For example, there's a 2004 paper titled Mind Reading and Metacognition: Narcissism, Not Actual Competence, Predicts Self-Estimated Ability. Then there's 2008's Why the Unskilled Are Unaware: Further Explorations of Absent Self-Insight Among the Incompetent. Ever have a colleague who's clearly incompetent but is applying for a managerial position? This cognitive bias explains why.
So some people, or as you said, all people at some point, think higher of themselves than what is reality. I mean, that could just be confidence, right? Well, interesting, what makes this personal bias matter? Or put another way, what's the impact in the bigger picture here?
It doesn't matter if my art sucks because no one will buy it. The market will weed me out. But what if the issue isn't just me trying to sell terrible paintings? Researchers are interested in the Dunning-Kruger effect because it can cause people to make bad decisions in more dangerous situations. So we can think of an aging driver who thinks they're better at driving than they are, who backs into their own mailbox all the time, or who accidentally plows into an occupied building, or a doctor who claims they can perform a procedure they've never done before, but botches it instead.
Yeah. Yikes. Got it.
On a micro scale, it may not matter if a high school student overestimates their knowledge of post-World War II history. But what if the impact's on a macro scale? What if thousands or even millions of people are affected by the decision of someone who's far more confident about their decisions than they should be? What's particularly scary about this cognitive bias is that people that experience it are more likely to reject constructive criticism. For example, a 2020 article on the Dunning-Kruger effect and physicians found that the bottom 25% in peer assessments rated themselves 30 to 40% higher than the others in their group, and we're more likely to reject feedback or see it as inaccurate or unhelpful. Do you want that position? I don't.
Got it. Get it. Yes. In that regard, I do understand. I think we could see that negative impact that you're talking about, that dangerous picture that you're painting here.
Right. And it's not just the professionals that suffer from the bad effects of this cognitive bias. In a study published in 2018, researchers asked 1,300 American adults questions about the link between autism and the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, MMR. Over a third of the respondents thought they knew as much or more than doctors and scientists about what causes autism. And those who objectively knew the least showed the most confidence. Let me unpack that. People who don't have any formal training in immunology, who almost certainly have no training in anything beyond the most basic biology, are claiming to have more knowledge than people who not only have PhDs in the subject, but who have worked for decades in that exact field. It's like me telling Tom Brady that I understand football better than he does because I read an article online about it. And for the record, I know nothing about football.
Right. And we have seen a lot of that out in the public forum, out in the internet.
Exactly. Also, the Dunning-Kruger effect upon the public when it comes to medical issues like vaccines is genuinely concerning because doctors and scientists exist for a reason, just as vaccines do. When uneducated individuals choose not to vaccinate their children, it places other members of the community in danger, particularly those at high risk. And indeed, as a result of the anti-vaccination movement, there have been serious outbreaks of the measles in Washington State, upstate New York, and New York City. One in four measles cases requires hospitalization, and complications can include permanent neurological damage and death. One person's decision not to vaccinate their children because they read an incorrect article on the internet can result in the death of another person's baby. People are free to make their own decision, informed or not, but when it comes to the health and safety of others, we need to work hard to counteract the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Agreed. So what can you tell us about what we need to do or what we need to know to combat the Dunning-Kruger effect?
Psychologist David Dunning, yes, that Dunning, suggests that individuals use devil's advocacy to challenge themselves. This bias is about a lack of insight and self-reflection, and devil's advocacy helps us attempt to develop that self-reflection. We could, for example, ask ourselves, what if my beliefs are wrong? Of course, this requires us to answer honestly and with full commitment, otherwise the exercise is moot. And as we just saw, the people most likely to be wrong are also the least likely to want to ask themselves if they are wrong. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try.
So walk us through how you would apply this kind of mindset.
So for example, someone who believes that vaccines cause autism could ask themselves, if that were true, why do no adults get autism after being vaccinated? What if vaccines don't cause autism? They would then be able to go through the full devil's advocacy approach, which we laid out earlier on this podcast, to seek out evidence to support that position. And hopefully they would be able to come up with a better understanding of how vaccines work and the lack of a relationship between vaccines and autism. Dunning also suggests seeking advice from others. When in conversation with someone else, you might find obvious misconceptions that you can then fix. And if that person is an actual expert on the subject, they might be able to offer concrete information you might not have had that might help change your mind. Again, this requires intellectual humility, recognizing that you are not an expert and learning from the experience of others. We all know someone for whom intellectual humility is not their forte, but we can strive to not be that person. Something to consider is that someone who self-identifies as a know-it-all really limits themselves. What room is there to grow? But a learn-it-all will constantly seek out new information, expanding their horizons and becoming a better-rounded individual. So if you find yourself being a know-it-all, maybe take a step backward and reorient yourself. Finally, another way to test for overconfidence is that when faced with a task or area of knowledge, ask yourself how you would accomplish the task or solve the problem. If you can't think of a clear and concrete plan, you've probably overestimated your ability. So for example, let's say you're one of those people who thinks they could land a plane if the pilot became incapacitated. Well, do you know how to lower the wing flaps? Do you know the correct airspeed and what the angle of attack on the nose should be? Do you even know what those things are? If you don't, probably you shouldn't try to land that plane. This method helps us overcome an overconfidence bias, which can contribute to the Dunning-Kruger effect.
I like what you said, a learn-it-all. I never heard that before. But this whole thing is so foreign to me. I would never think that I could land a plane. maybe help someone out in the street, attempt CPR for the first time. Yes, but landing a plane, it's wild to hear that's even a thing that people would think they can do. Okay, so Karen, I'm going to go a little rogue this week, and I think I have enough time, but I'd really like to know if you personally have a story about being overconfident.
Oh yeah, I do it a lot, unfortunately. And I've made some mistakes that make me sound like a pretty big moron. And again, this is another opportunity to remind listeners that at one point or another, we all do this. We all suffer from the Dunning-Kruger effect. So the first example that comes to mind, I was in a meeting with a very senior guy, and he asked me when the Balfour Declaration was issued. For anyone that loves history, this was a public statement that the British put out announcing the UK's support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And I am terrible at dates. And I know that. I know I'm terrible at dates. But for some reason, my brain said I should answer this question because I believed I was right. And I said 1920. And the actual date is 1917. Even though this was years ago, I still think about this at night sometimes. Why did I speak up? I'm horrible at dates. Why did I say that? And 3 years is a big time to be off when it comes to dates in that particular period of history. By answering that question and by giving the wrong date, which a whole bunch of people in the room knew was wrong, I undermined my own credibility.
So why do we do things like this? Why are we so quick to talk over listening or learning?
According to Dunning, the reason we're so confident, even when we're wrong, is that we're applying a mental rule. It's just the wrong one. For example, if you ask someone which weighs more, a 1 pound bag of feathers or a 1 pound bag of lead, most people answer the bag of lead. To get that answer, they're applying a rule about lead being heavy and feathers being light. But because of the snap rule, they're not hearing the part about both bags weighing 1 pound, meaning that both bags weigh the same amount. So while someone who answers the lead bag is wrong, it's not because they're dumb, it's because of a misapplication of a rule. Or in my case, I'm just terrible at dates.
Okay, well, it does seem that some of these questions are solely asked to be trick questions in order to help train folks away from this type of bias. Is that possible?
It is a trick, but only in the sense that we know that most people will answer the question wrong. If it's meant to train people, it's meant to train them to actually listen to the information being given rather than rushing to conclusions. But a little knowledge goes too far, too. We often get ourselves most into trouble when we know a little bit of information about a subject, and then we think we understand that subject fully, or that the same knowledge can be applied to a different subject. So for example, individuals who go through driver's education courses actually perform worse in the long term when confronting difficult road conditions because they're overconfident about their abilities. And maybe don't take advice about golf from a tennis player.
I find myself wondering, if we all do this, how has it served us in a positive way? Like, is it part of our evolution?
I can't answer that question. I'll leave that to the social psychologists or evolutionary biologists or whoever is best positioned to answer. See, I'm trying to avoid the Dunning-Kruger effect that would prompt me to hazard a guess when I have absolutely no training in either of those two subjects.
That's fair. Okay, so I'd like to stay on this for a bit. What are some well-known examples, or what are some examples that come to mind for you guys that we're all aware of? Maybe some really egregious ones. I will preface that these are borderline subjectives. They're coming from us. But what are some ones that you guys have to talk about?
For me, the worst Dunning-Kruger effect offender I can think of is Gwyneth Paltrow. Look, Paltrow is clearly a talented actress. She has an Oscar, a Golden Globe, and an Emmy to prove it. She also does philanthropic work. For example, she's on the board of the Robin Hood Foundation, a charity that seeks to reduce poverty in New York City. But Paltrow is also notorious for giving advice based on discredited pseudoscience and selling products with false advertising through her company, Goop. And that's a problem. Paltrow started a college degree in art history but dropped out to pursue acting. That means she has no academic training in things like biology or nutrition. And it shows. To quote her Wikipedia page, Goop, and by extension Paltrow, have faced backlash for showcasing expensive products and promoting medically and scientifically impossible treatments, many of which have harmful consequences. The controversies have included vaginal steaming, the use of jade eggs, a dangerous coffee enema device, and body vibes, wearable stickers that were claimed to rebalance the energy frequency in our bodies, and which Goop falsely claimed were made of NASA-developed material. Other Goop claims revolve around pseudoscience topics like energy healing, psychedelic drugs, and cold therapy. After being sued by the state of California in 2020, Goop agreed to stop making any claims regarding the efficacy or effects of any of its products unless it has competent and reliable scientific evidence that substantiates the claims. I think the lesson here is maybe don't trust celebrities for medical advice.
I find this really interesting. I have my own personal opinions about Goop. But with this one, are there any specific examples of misleading or false claims that have faced any legal issues?
According to Timothy Caulfield, a University of Alberta professor of law and public health and author of Is Gwyneth Paltrow Wrong About Everything? How the Famous Sell Us Elixirs of Health, Beauty, and Happiness, pretty much every Goop claim has some degree of falseness. In interviews, however, he particularly points out detoxes and cleanses, perhaps because for fun, he tried one. The point Caulfield makes is that there's no scientific evidence to support either approach. Put very succinctly, these are fads that have no basis in reality, but sound good and are peddled among new age so-called lifestyle gurus. When people like Paltrow or singer Katy Perry rave about the positive effects, we're really just seeing the placebo effect in action. They feel better because they believe they'll feel better and their body responds accordingly. In truth, they're not adjusting their gut bacteria or filtering toxins any differently than before they tried these diets.
Thank you, Karen. And I'm sure there are so many more examples we could discuss of celebrities peddling those fake cures. But I do want to make sure we have enough time for Caitlin. Caitlin, I know you have examples for us as well.
Yeah, Bobbi Jann, I really do love discussing this bias because I can think of so many more day-to-day examples of the Dunning-Kruger effect. For example, I'm in a fantasy football league with some coworkers and a fantasy hockey league with some friends. And I think that this bias applies perfectly to some people who participate in fantasy sports. Now, don't get me wrong. I do love watching Sunday football and closely follow the Islanders hockey team. But fantasy sports for me and for a lot of other people are just a way to have fun with friends and family and stay connected to sports. But inevitably, there's always someone in the league who either one has played that sport before, so they think those skills will somehow translate into managing an imaginary team of players, or two, is an absolute diehard superfan of a particular sport or team, and they believe that knowledge will make them a shoo-in for first place, especially among casual fans, like people like me. But in my experience, it's those people who believe they have some type of special expertise that end up completely underperforming.
Admittedly, I have zero interest in football or fantasy football, but how would you even quantify something like this?
I wish there was some sort of scientific way that we could study this so it doesn't just seem like I'm using my own anecdotal experiences to try and convince you that the Dunning-Kruger effect exists in fantasy sports. But think about it. A person with an inflated sense of their own fantasy sports ability will fail to recognize their own lack of skill, fail to recognize the skill of others in the league, and honestly, just fail to acknowledge the unpredictability of professional sports in general. You never know when somebody's going to get injured or suspended. I had an individual on one of my teams who pushed a Kansas City Chiefs cameraman and he was sued. So now he's being suspended by the league. I don't get his points until his suspension is over.
That sounds heartbreaking. It sounds like a terrible thing. But I mean, it seems like even the most experienced professionals find it difficult to be good at or even consistent with predictions.
Yeah, you're 100% right, Bobbi Jann. But I also just find this topic particularly funny because in some leagues, the consequences of being overconfident and then underperforming can be very humiliating. Like, have you guys ever heard of the Waffle House marathon punishment?
No.
It's where the league loser has to spend 24 hours in a Waffle House restaurant, but each waffle you eat knocks off 1 hour of punishment time. I think personally, I could maybe eat, I don't know, 8 waffles, but that would leave me stuck sitting in a Waffle House for another 16 straight hours. I think I would go absolutely nuts.
I've never heard of that. I've never even been to a Waffle House, but I do know that Waffle House is used for FEMA. I digress. I'm not a huge fan of football in general. What other examples do you have, Caitlin?
I mean, there's examples everywhere, but we can talk about talent shows, like American Idol, America's Got Talent, Britain's Got Talent, all those types of shows. Using American Idol specifically, something like 100,000 people audition for American Idol each season. How can so many people think that they're the next Carrie Underwood or Kelly Clarkson? Sure, you can say that a small percentage of those people show up to sing poorly and be outrageous just so they can get on TV. But there's an even larger percentage of auditioners who mistakenly believe they're extremely talented. Those people are genuinely distraught when they don't get their golden ticket to Hollywood. Don't get me wrong, The compilations of horrible singers that American Idol puts together and airs make for great entertainment and were particularly iconic in the early 2000s. Sometimes I watch them on YouTube. But how can these people be so out of touch?
Ooh, pick me. Let me guess. Are they victims of Dunning-Kruger?
Of course. It's so hard for people to judge themselves accurately.
So let's pivot a little bit. Laura, thank you for joining us today. Do you have any examples of Dunning-Kruger in action?
Thank you. It's such a pleasure, especially since I love this one so much. So yes, I do. And for the record, Caitlin, I so heart those American Idol contestants. And sometimes I wonder, do their families and loved ones just let it go? Or have they tried to give them honest feedback? Or maybe the Dunning-Kruger effect runs that deep. Anyway, I might be dating myself, but I often think of fictional characters in comedies that illustrate the Dunning-Kruger effect, like the iconic Michael Scott from The Office or Ron Burgundy of Anchorman. These characters are literally living in a Dunning-Kruger world. And it is funny to watch them obliviously go through life without a shred of self-awareness or a genuine care to self-reflect. Laughing at them feels good, not least because we think we could never go through life that deluded, could we? Of course, we know we all fall victim to this effect. But I can never forget Will Ferrell's Ron Burgundy admitting, "I'm not quite sure how to put this, but I'm kind of a big deal." Or Michael Scott waxing poetic on his management philosophy, answering the question, "Would I rather be feared or loved?" That's easy. Both. I want people to be afraid of how much they love me. I mean, comedy gold, right? But if I really had a boss like Michael Scott, I would be in a living hell. And if I ever met Ron Burgundy catcalling women on the streets of San Diego while mansplaining to his women coworkers, I'd be utterly disgusted.
I am like, are we in an alternate universe? What do you mean dating yourself? Those icons were introduced to us like 5 years ago, and I said what I said.
Okay, true. To be fair, though, Michael Scott in The Office season one premiered in the US over 15 years ago.
No.
It's true. Anchorman was released in the theaters in 2004. Seriously, though, I suppose my point is that while a complete lack of self-awareness in a fictional universe can be super humorous, even in a cringy way, it is symbolic of a much more sinister reality, as Karen mentioned earlier. To me, the slippery slope of the Dunning-Kruger effect is that living without self-reflection often leads to surrounding oneself with other people similar to oneself. And ironically, and perhaps unintentionally, the more information to which we have access these days, the less we use that information to challenge our own ability to critically think about these things. In a sense, unchecked Dunning-Kruger effect enables one to get through their day without questioning anything they read or hear, while becoming increasingly vulnerable to, say, conspiracy theories or cults of personality demagogues and confidence people. I think about the radicalization of people online. They are living in their own Dunning-Kruger echo chambers, and it is fairly easy to imagine the snowball effect of maintaining such delusions. So going back to Caitlin's more innocent example, it's not just the person auditioning with the Dunning-Kruger effect that sustains the bias. It's also the folks around them reinforcing it, parents, friends, partners, and others who may not have the ability or the desire to check that delusion.
Thank you, Laura. I'm still spinning about how references to Scott and Burgundy date us with my quote fingers. I really can't handle that right now. I know there were additional portions of the Dunning-Kruger that we wanted to talk about. Karen, it was like a subcategory. Tell us a little more about that.
Right. It's called the better than average effect. Basically, it means that most people view themselves as being better than average when it comes to desirable traits like intelligence, friendliness, and sincerity. It's also called illusory superiority, or the Lake Wobegon effect. The effect has been proven time and again by studies, and many people think it's a contributing factor to the Dunning-Kruger effect. I love this effect because it's pure comedic gold. For example, in a study of faculty at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, 94% of the faculty rated themselves as being above average for teaching ability. Statistically, we can see the problem immediately. And we can just imagine how the better than average effect plays out with online dating. What do you think, Bobby Jane? Think you're smarter and better looking than the average person?
Okay, so real talk. I actually like to believe I'm a pretty realistic person and I have a good grasp on reality. And that's something I have worked pretty hard to achieve. I try not to be too hard on myself because I'm actually more prone to think less of myself than I should. You know, I don't have a lot of knowledge in the Dunning-Kruger effect personally, but I do have personal experience that falls on the opposite ends of the spectrum. I know that I personally underestimate my abilities and expertise. I realized that earlier on in my career, when I was applying for jobs or not applying, I should say, to jobs for which I didn't think I was qualified. When explaining or defending that to friends and colleagues about why I wasn't going for the job per se, I found out essentially the following. Women, in comparison to men, underestimate their abilities and performance, while men significantly overestimate it, regardless of the fact that their performance are of equal quality. Studies consistently find that women will only apply for promotions when they believe they meet 100% of the qualifications listed for the job. When I hear that, that really resonates with me. My brain's like, well, yeah, obviously, why would I apply if I don't check off every box? And men, on the other hand, they're over here happily applying to jobs, even when they meet 60% of the job requirements. I found that study to be astonishing. First, because it means I'm not alone in my way of thinking. And two, it's a systemic issue. Obviously, we could dive into that with causes and glass ceilings and conditionings and fears. But even that bit of knowledge was eye-opening for me. Ultimately, very empowering. And I think this bias exists on a spectrum. And I imagine there are just as many examples on both ends of it.
Definitely. And there's imposter syndrome too. But I think we're out of time. We'll just have to talk about that another time.
All right, friends. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. In next week's episode, we'll be discussing groupthink, which is exactly what it sounds like when all the people in a group all think alike. I mean, what could possibly go wrong, right? Well, tune in next time to find out. And thank you for listening to Gossipint.